Hi, Volodymyr.
Hello, hello, Bob.
How are you?
I'm pretty much okay, but
Yeah, I know. Things you are in Kiev, right? And yes, and things aren't necessarily so great in Ukraine right now. Let me introduce us quickly. You are Volodymyr Yermolenko, and you are with InterNews Ukraine is the name of your of the NGO you work with. Is
Yeah,
that right?
exactly. Yeah, that's right.
And what is it you do there exactly? Or what does the organization do, and what do you do?
Well, this is a media NGO working in Ukraine since 1996, and we're working with media. We're making lots of education stuff for media, teaching them new skills like in new media or in international journalism. We also are dealing with well, international journalism a lot, and with European affairs, for example. So this is my scope of responsibility. I'm a director of EU related projects, so I'm leading the projects which Internews has in the European dimension with the European Union, with the EU institutions, and etc. So I'm pretty much in the context of what's going on between EU and Ukraine, and all the things around it.
And as I'm sure most of our viewers know, the European Union is very much related to how Ukraine found itself in the position it's in today. That is the separatist movement in eastern Ukraine and so on. But more immediately, of course, we have this airliner having been downed in eastern Ukraine, and I wanted to talk to you a little about that. The story, and we should say we're recording this on Friday, late afternoon, US time and evening your time. The story as we have it so far seems to be that the airliner was downed by a missile fired from rebel-held territory in eastern Ukraine. What is the story as you have it there? I mean, what are people in your part of Ukraine saying about what happened or what they think happened?
Well, this is pretty much the same story that basically there were indications that the separatists are getting heavy armaments since at least late June, and in late June they captured these highly sophisticated. They were proud of having captured this highly sophisticated anti-aircraft technique, anti-aircraft missiles machine, which is called Buk. Now they are denying that they're possessing it, but in late June they were proud of capturing it.
And they captured it from Ukrainian government forces, is that right?
Yeah, this is right, but you can't say really whether this was the Buk which was used during this
Right.
attack, or this was the Buk which was which was basically brought from Russia, because these are basically equipment produced by Russians.
Right. And Buk is BUK, the way I'm seeing it spelled. That's the name of the missile system. And it's a Russian-made missile system, but the Ukrainian forces were in possession of some of them, and the rebels seemed to have or had claimed to have gotten stolen some from the Ukrainian forces. And this kind of matters because in terms of mustering a response to what happened, as the U.S. and Europe decide how to respond to this. I guess the more directly Russia is implicated, the stronger the response is likely to be. So
Well,
it.
exactly. Therefore, I'd like to add is that here in Kyiv, the real debate is whether it was the rebellion strike, meaning that whether these BUK books were basically directed by the separatists, and of course there should be some very highly sophisticated technical stuff. Because it's a very, very difficult machine, or else it could probably possibly even was the attack from the Russian territory, because it's very close,
Right. I mean, I was going to say it also matters Politically, it matters probably whether the missiles were, assuming the separatists did it, which I think is the most likely thing personally from what I've seen, then it matters whether the missiles were provided directly by Russia or seized from the Ukrainian government. I mean, I just think it may matter a little politically. Because again, the more directly Russia is involved.
Well, again, even if it's even if the missiles were only captured, you know,
right.
It's impossible to imagine that these separatists who are many of them, if they are locals, because there are many locals, you know,
right.
from Eastern Ukraine, but they're amateurs, and you have to have professionals, real professionals who would drive and who would direct the strike, etc. And these professionals are most probably Russian professionals.
Because you're saying because it's a fairly complex missile system.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And what we are observing in Eastern Ukraine is basically, of course, there are people who are taking arms for their purposes from the local population, but they're directed by Russians. Many,
right.
For example, Mr. Girkin or Mr. Other misters who are directing these operations are mostly Russians, and then so the Russians can be the inspiring force behind it.
Right. Yeah. No, there definitely is evidence of Russian involvement in the sense of people with who very recently were in Russia and even had high positions in the Russian military or in Russian intelligence being in Eastern Ukraine and giving guidance or advice or something to the rebels. I've definitely seen evidence to that effect. There was I guess it's conceivable if these missiles were in the possession of the Ukrainian armed forces, then there are people in the Ukrainian armed forces who knew how to use them. So I guess it's conceivable that some of the rebels had acquired the knowledge that way. But I take your point that probably the more likely theory is that there was some kind of Russian guidance. I wanted to ask you about one little bit of, in these intercepted phone calls that we've heard, one of them between rebels and someone in Russia, I think. There were a couple of different phone calls that were intercepted right after the airliner came down. And in one of them, the person in Eastern Ukraine reports that it was shot down by the Cossacks, right? Is that what you had? What you've heard?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Now, what exactly does that mean? Because in the West, Cossacks, when we hear Cossacks in America, we think of these guys on horseback, 100 years ago, in a movie, Dr. Zhivago or something. And but Cossacks, first of all, they are a real thing in Russia today. I didn't realize. What does it mean to say that there are Cossacks in Ukraine? Does that mean they are, if they're being described that way, would that mean they are definitely Russians who came from Russia or what?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the word Cossacks is a very ambiguous because initially the Cossacks were Ukrainians from Zaporizhia who were fighting against the Tatars, the Turks, and the Polish. But mm-hmm. then, after Ukraine joined Russian Empire in the 17th century, it was kind of a very long story when some of these Cossacks were moving to Don, where now the so-called the Cossacks of Don, the river which is basically on the Russian territory and on the regions which are very close to Ukraine, the Rostov region and others. But progressively, these Cossacks in the 19th century, for example, they were turning into the kind of a very, semi-anarchic nationalistic group. And it was already quite symbolic in the early 20th century. Now they're basically trying to revive these traditions of Russian Kazakhs, they're saying Kazakhs, and Ukrainians are saying Cossacks. But yeah, today being Kazakh in Russia means somebody who support the Russian imperialist strength and the idea that they will, you know, kind of recover the old territories which were previously under Russian Empire. So these are, of course, the Russians who came from Rostov region.
Uh-huh. Okay. So there aren't, and do they have any official status with respect to the Russian government? I mean, do they, or are they just,
well,
you know?
I think there is kind of an NGO, you know, something like
yeah,
that. So
right.
The organizations, in Ukraine, you have also the Cossack organizations, but I mean, the traditions are different. So Ukrainian tradition goes back to this Zaporizhia Cossacks of, you know, 16th and 17th century. And this is kind of also a part of our identity. This is a part of this identity of a frontier, of a borderland, you know, against mm-hmm. which we're protecting, in a way, the borderland between different civilizations, between European civilization and Eurasian civilization, for example. But then it moved and it turned very paradoxically into an image of a Russian nationalist. But of course, there are antagonistic, because, for example, on Maidan, you had a very strong Cossack, but Ukrainian Cossack identity and some people who were, you know, affiliating themselves with this old Cossack Zaporizhia tradition. But of course, they are antagonistic with this Russian Kazakhs. And basically, in eastern Ukraine, in this Donbas region, these Russian Kazakhs are playing quite a role. So this is, these are the mobiles, mobile male groups which are sometimes ready to fight and.
Mm-hmm. And these would be, so the people described in this phone conversation, they would, given the context, you're saying they would be not just ethnic Russian Ukrainian Cossacks, but they would be Russian Cossacks who have come over fairly recently from Russia.
Yeah, most probably. I mean, there are probably some people from Ukraine who would tell you, well, now I'm Kazakh, you know, and now I'll enroll into a Kazakh organization. But the chief of that, and the person who was on this conversation, I forgot his last name, who's leading these Kazakhs. He's basically presenting himself as an officer of GRU. The GRU is the chief intelligence department in Russia. So it's basically the intelligence and sometimes diversant force. And many GRU people are behind these incidents in eastern Ukraine, especially in April. And they were there, so they were leading the special operations. Then mm-hmm. they some kind of disappeared, leaving mostly the affair to some other people. But now the information which is spread now by some Ukrainian experts is saying that these people are coming back. So these leading mm-hmm. professionals in these semi-military or special operations are coming back to eastern Ukraine from Russia.
Right. Now, those same telephone calls I talked about, the telephone conversations, seem to suggest that the people who shot this airplane down thought they were shooting down a Ukrainian military transport plane, or at least some Ukrainian military plane. And I think that's the most common interpretation I'm hearing. Is that what people are saying?
Yeah,
where you are as
basically
well?
This is it. And this phone conversation is the major source for it, but also some statements made by the chief of the separatists, Mr. Girkin, who wrote on his page in social networks the same information. There are screenshots. He then deleted it, but there are screenshots saying that basically there was kind of a feeling of a joy that they shot down a Ukrainian transport military aircraft, mm-hmm. but then they realized that this is not military aircraft. And this is very interesting because you know, I heard some ideas which were basically, of course, are present in the Russian media, and are very much manipulated, but also present in some Western, especially European media. And people were saying, like, look, separatists are not that technically equipped and they're not, you know, capable of shooting down planes. But we should understand that this is not the first time. And mm-hmm. they succeeded already. And I think some other power told this, said this today in the UN Security Council. And this is very right to say, because they already shot down a couple of Ukrainian planes, especially these, I think there were two, these transport aircrafts, and the last story was a couple of days ago, I think on the 14th of July, when they shot down an An-26, the Ukrainian military transport aircraft, and basically they were thinking they are now shutting down the same.
And back when the one transport plane they shot down was flying at 21,000 feet. Which suggests that they were at that point using weapon systems like this. In other words, they were using a weapon system that could also shoot down an airliner at 33,000 feet, which this was. So
yeah.
We already had evidence that they had more than these kind of shoulder fired anti-aircraft
weapons. I'm not a military expert, and I cannot judge because you know there are different equipment and etc. Mm-hmm. So. We have to talk with a really military expert. But the thing I'm trying to say is that this is not the first time. This is the fifth time when the separatists, the terrorists, are shooting down a plane, an aircraft. There were helicopters too in eastern Ukraine. This is very important to understand. So the phone call, the intercepted phone call, shows that these people were. Initially glad to shoot down this transport aircraft, and they realized that there was a passenger aircraft and there were no military equipment on it, and this basically passenger aircraft. Then they were really shocked, but the end of the conversation is that they're trying to justify this deed, saying, well, You should stay away. Well, there are obscene words in this conversation, but the sense is that you should all stay away from our skies because this is our skies, which right. is absolutely, I mean, insane, you know. And they were also saying that these planes are trying to distribute spies over their territory. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also interesting because when you follow. If you follow the versions which are produced by these people, they are absolutely crazy. I mean, Girkin, the chief of the terrorists, was saying today that basically the Americans put the dead bodies into the plane, and these 300 people, some of them were already dead for a couple of days. So it was a kind of a. I mean, he's judging because. From some his hypothesis that they were not bleeding enough or something, and which is totally insane. I mean, they're thinking in terms of you know some devils who are trying to manipulate with them and who are sending a plane with dead bodies on board, which is, I mean, this is the way how they think. Their thinking is absolutely mythological and absolutely irrational, and we have to understand it.
Now, where you are in Kiev, I assume people are talking about what this might lead to, right? This can change. This can change things in various ways. But you know, as I said, the United States and Europe are still trying to figure out how they will respond. What kinds of things are you hearing about how it is likely to change things, or maybe about how people you know are hoping it will change things?
Well, of course, we see the support from several countries. We appreciate very much support from the United States, from Canada, from Britain, from Australia. Then, of course, and from Poland, of course. Then, of course, and from Baltic states. Then, of course, there is a huge debate in Ukraine whether the rest of Europe supports us or not. And whether the rest of Europe understands the real threat of Russian aggression. or the rest of Europe tries to, you know, to find a compromise, some kind of a compromise position with the dictator and with the aggressor. But the important thing today was a kind of a shift in the position of Germany, it seems to me. I hope so, because Angela Merkel was saying really tough things for Russia, and she was saying that she had a phone talk with Putin, and they had very diverging opinions. And then he dissuaded France from selling Mistrals, which are big helicopter carriers. All this story that France is selling helicopter carriers for Russia, and Russia is willing to impose to dislocate them in the Black Sea. So we are hoping for change in European policy too, and for example that the sanctions against Russia will be stronger. At least there is a political decision on the 16th of July that there will be some kind of a progress in sanctions, and we expect what the EU foreign ministers will decide on 22nd of July, so next week.
And do you think?
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
But of course, I mean, we understand perfectly that this event can be an event of no return, because this is a really tragic event, and you've probably seen how Ukrainians are sympathizing to the victims and how many flowers and candles they were bringing to the embassies, to Dutch embassy and other embassies, and to American embassy too. And this is absolutely shocking and inhumane, unbelievable tragedy for us. But we also understand that this is might be a turning point, because it can lead to radicalizing of everything, to radicalization of Russians, radicalization of Ukrainians, etc., etc. And one more thing is basically, it shows that the war went beyond Ukrainian borders, and Europe cannot no longer think that Ukraine is a buffer zone between Russia and the European Union.
And do you think more sanctions will make a difference? They haven't seemed to make much difference so far.
Well, no. I think they are making difference. I think this is the most important thing. One of the most important things, basically, of which Putin is afraid of, because basically he's a personality who seeks a kind of respect in the West. He probably creates this anti-American hysteria in Russia, but he still wants to be, you know, respected in the West. And his strategy was, as I see it, his strategy was strategy of little wars, not the big breakthrough blitzkriegs like Hitler's or something, but really, you know, little wars. He captured some of Georgia, and then he had, you know, five year pause, and then he captured some part of Ukraine, Crimea. Then he tried to he increased this absolutely hysterical feeling in Russia, but then he tried to calm it down. And the tens of recent weeks were showing that basically he was kind of afraid of this ultra-nationalism in Russia, and basically calls of citizens for direct intervention. He was afraid of it, yeah.
But he doesn't he seem to have been providing the rebels with things like these missiles? I mean, maybe we don't know that for sure, but don't we know with fair confidence that some Russian tanks have come over?
Yeah,
he does seem to be supplying and supporting the rebels,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, but this is a strategy of destabilizing Ukraine, but keeping an image that they have nothing to do with that. So.
Right, but my point is that the economic sanctions have not stopped him from doing that, right?
Yes, but I mean, this is also his strategy, because his strategy is to make Ukraine seem like a failed state, right? Mm. So be cut off from trade with Russia, because trade with Russia is important for us, or trade with all our neighbors. Mm. And well, this is kind of a, of course, they probably these sanctions at this moment didn't quite dissuade him from helping the rebels, the separatists, but he would be doing this anyway, because I mean, as I repeat, his strategy is to destabilize the country without really showing it to anybody.
Are there people hoping that this the downing of the airliner will lead to something more like military assistance of Ukraine, whether through the supplying of weapons, say, by the West, or conceivably through actual military participation?
Well, people might be expecting that, although I don't really believe that this could be real, that the Western countries will be militarily present here.
Mm-hmm.
But of course the Ukrainians, I mean, like all other people, we're not willing war, and we are experiencing this war, and there are people who are fighting in Eastern Ukraine, and every day we see the reports that some people were killed, some people are wounded, some people have lost their hands, their legs, etc., etc. So probably, of course, we're expecting some military help or financial assistance, but we don't want to go on war. And this is, nobody wants to go on war. You know, the Ukrainians yeah. want peace, and this is the biggest concern. The only problem is that, of course, we don't want peace for any price. And our impression sometimes that some Europeans, for them, they want peace for any price, and the price could be even the independence or real independence of Ukraine. That of course will not be possible, because we're already losing lives for that. And yeah.
Well, what about that? I mean, you said that Putin's goal is to destabilize Ukraine. There is also the view that there is something he would settle for other than the actual sovereignty of Eastern Ukraine. In other words, you know, people talk about a kind of federalism where some of the provinces in Eastern Ukraine would have enough autonomy that, first of all, they could have very robust economic relations with Russia, but also they might have the ability to, say, veto Ukraine's joining NATO or something like that. You know, you do hear this idea that there is a deal that could be made that would involve some degree of autonomy for parts of Eastern Ukraine, and that could end the fighting. Do you think that's credible, or that it would be acceptable?
This is a pretext. This is basically an idea he launches, I mean, a humanistic idea that these regions should have their own rights, etc., which is a perfect idea. I mean, nobody is challenging that in Ukraine. Poroshenko came up with a plan, the president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, came up with a plan of decentralize the country and saying that, look, we all know that we have, you know, some over-centralized country probably, and that many taxes collected locally go to the central level, to Kyiv. They probably should stay in the regions, they probably should mm-hmm. stay in small towns, they probably should stay in your oblasts, your region, your towns, your cities, etc. He also said that one third of his inauguration speech was in Russian, and he was saying basically he was addressing this region. So there's no problem with that, no problem at all. And I think that this is just a pretext. I mean, Putin doesn't need Donbass. Why would he need Donbass? Does he need some resources? No, he has enough resources. I mean, Crimea strategically, well, probably it's important because it's a Black Sea and etc. But Donbass for Putin strategically is nothing. It's probably the region that when Ukraine could have produced shale gas, but this is only in theory. So the idea is really, you know, the idea is to not destabilize Ukraine as a whole. So his goal is to keep Ukraine as a whole, if not in Russian orbit, then kind of a black space, a black spot. Because if you have a country on which our territory of which planes are crashing or the continuous warfare is going on, well, nobody would think of investing into it, for example. This is his objective.
Do you think that Putin still has enough control over the rebels that he could bring a halt to the fighting if he wanted?
No, I don't think so. I think the recent events showed that basically the events are pretty much improvising. I think, I don't remember, I think it's George Friedman's phrase that, well, any war is starting when one of the sides is preparing a special operation for years, and then everybody starts to improvise. So Crimea was a special operation prepared for years since 2008, at least by Russians. That's clear, because it was absolutely ideal operation of annexation of the whole peninsula without, you know, shots, without anything. But then everybody was improvising. And I think that basically this crashed aircraft is not in plans of Putin. Because his strategy was on the one hand help the separatists in order to keep the confrontation, because otherwise Ukrainian army would be victorious, would get a victory. But on the other hand, he tried to pacify his own population and dissuade it from supporting the idea of the full-scale intervention. And why? Because he was trying to reestablish his image in the West, and Donbass was necessary, because there was an argument, look, why annex Crimea? Because if I didn't annex Crimea, then you would have the same Donbass in Crimea. Now I annexed Crimea and everybody is glad and there is peace in the peninsula. So Donbass is a huge argument, but he doesn't mention only one fact that basically his annexation of Crimea and then all these massacres in Donbass were created by, first of all, by the initial lie, absolutely incredible lie, which was spread through by Russian propaganda, meaning that there is a junta, a fascist junta, who took power in Kyiv, and that Maidan was a fascist, you know, Maidan, etc., etc.
Right.
So nobody, I mean, annexation of Crimea was made on the pretext that there will be now fascists going to Crimea and, you know, trying to impose Ukrainian language, etc. Nobody was willing that. Nobody was thinking about that.
No, although of course the law that the parliament passed, the new parliament passed, about the Russian language, and I understand that the law was ultimately vetoed,
yes,
but I do think that frightened a lot of people in eastern Ukraine in a way that he could exploit.
Yes, but if you talk to them rationally, I mean, this law was unconstitutional, and it was adopted by Yanukovych. And,
sure, but it was an expression of the parliament that was in fact in power in Kiev. It was an expression of their views.
Yeah, nobody, I think, is questioning that this step was a mistake. It was a kind of a mistake, one of the first steps after Maidan. This step was a mistake, but I mean, it's ridiculous to get this step as a reason for a war. You know, you don't go for a war just because, you know, your Russian language is considered a little bit lower status. I mean, anywhere in Ukraine, everybody who is visiting Ukraine knows that Russian language is much more present than Ukrainian, and the Kyiv is a mostly still Russian speaking city. And Maidan was mostly Russian-speaking event.
Mm-hmm. So if indeed, as you seem to believe, Putin does not have all that much control over the rebels, what is the most you can hope for as a result of more pressure on Putin via sanctions and so on? I mean, if the situation is out of control, what good is that going to do?
Well, he can stop supplying armament. He can withdraw all these Gru officers. And this is it. This is what was happening basically a couple of weeks ago when Girkin went out of Slovyansk and etc. So this showed that if Russia stops real support, then the days of these separatists are, you know, are very scarce, and they will be ultimately they would ultimately lose. But then Russia again reestablished the strategy of sending troops, well, not troops, but sending armaments, sending their specialists, etc., etc.
Well, even the, remember, after the rebels kind of retreated to Donetsk, I guess it was, and they blew up, like, these bridges around Donetsk to, you know, to impede the advance of the Ukrainian military. That seemed to me, just the blowing up of all the bridges seemed to me the type of thing that probably had some Russian support, right? I mean, you know, a group of recently formed rebels, you know, probably doesn't have a whole lot of expertise in explosives and, you know, and isn't used to coordinating things like that.
Yeah, but there are, I mean, let's not also underestimate them, because there are people, you know, who deserted from Ukrainian police. There are people who basically deserted from Ukrainian some special police unit. Well, there are people who lost their relatives, and I mean, these are tragic events, and here in Kyiv we are far from thinking in terms of, you know, enemies and friends only. Most of the people understand that these are tragic events, and imagine a person who lost a life of his wife or of his children from, you know, from an attack in Slavyansk. For example, of course, he would take arms and go against the Ukrainian army. This is the tragedy of war, and different people can be there. But of course, the leadership is mostly by this kind of very well trained military supply from Russia.
So it sounds like your view is that we can't hope for Putin just snapping his fingers and ending the violence. What you can hope for is his withdrawing, ongoing logistical support, and his ceasing to supply weapons, and maybe ideally even sealing the border and keeping more people from coming over, in a way that would basically ensure that Ukraine would be able to suppress the rebellion. That's kind of the most you can hope for.
Again, this puts Putin under very difficult situation at home, because he exceeded, he exaggerated the mood. He created this idea that, well, we are going from the epoch, from times of consolidating Russia into times of reconquering our old territories, old Russian territories. And so they reconquered Crimea. This was the first step. Then they are willing to reconquer what they are calling a new Russia, Novorossiya, meaning the Donbas and the south of Ukraine, and going to the west to Transnistria. And then you say, no, we are not intervening. And this creates a very, very tricky, you know, sentiment in Russia, and very tricky sentiment, because they're considering already, it never happened before, but they seem to be very afraid of Ukrainians. They're creating an image of very, you know, hostile and cruel Ukrainians, which is not the case, because Ukrainians are mostly kind people without any expansionist, you know, ambitions. But imagine they understand that basically they lose the war for east of Ukraine, and they consider it as their personal loss, as the loss of Russia in a war against Ukraine, because I mean, now it's a war of Russia against Ukraine. And what would you say, what would you have then in Putin rating? Because basically he started all this project with Crimea, etc., when he had the lowest rating at home since during all his presidencies, and now he has the highest. So the Crimean annexation brought his rating to the highest, topmost of the point. But then there is nowhere to grow. There will be only a decrease, you know, and there can be a very sharp decrease, because if he doesn't intervene, there are many nationalist forces in Russia who are already saying that basically Putin is not decisive enough and that we should intervene, etc., etc.
And this is the reason I think, you know, for political purposes at home, he would at least need to be able to point to something he could call victory, which brings us back to this federalism business. Exactly. You know, he'd need to at least be able to say, well, these provinces in Eastern Europe now have more autonomy and blah, 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 right? And
exactly. But this is, I mean, this is something which Ukrainian authorities are suggesting. Right. And that's the basic,
but
that's his basic mistake, that he lost the chance to say, look, there is a new president in Ukraine, but we are strong enough to, you know, to force him to speak Russian and to admit that the Russian language will have a special status and they will have an autonomy. So they lost this chance already. And there was a huge peace chance after this inauguration of Poroshenko, which was basically missed by Russians.
And now it seems like he almost can't do this because it seems harder and harder for him to do it, if only because he seems to have less and less control over the rebels. So it's like, you know, he can't do a deal that would lead to the cessation of hostilities in exchange for this federalism, right? I mean, I guess, you know, in principle, you know, it just seems very complicated. It seems like getting any kind of clean deal done is really hard.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So where that leaves us is that the rebels have fallen back to Donetsk, right? And it's a big city with about 1 million people. And the expectation is, according to what I read, that if the Ukrainian military is going to win there, it's going to have to do like a lot of bombardment of the city, and it's going to be very, very messy. It's not going to be like a surgical operation, right? And, of course, that risks further alienating the population and possibly creating more support than there already is for the rebels.
Yes, there is a risk of it. Of course, there is a danger of it. I mean, and we will see how the things will evolve in these cities which are now under Ukrainian control, whether the citizens will will consider the reestablishment of the Ukrainian power is a kind of a positive or negative.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, this is a very, very tricky, very difficult situation. And we'll see how the things will change. But,
okay,
of course, here in Ukraine, we see that, well, we are living in an everyday flow of news, which are very tragic news and which are not promising anything good. Even if we win, which I really hope, of course, this injury will last for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so final question. You are in Kiev in Western Ukraine, and you know your sympathies are clear. You support the Ukrainian government and its attempt to suppress the rebellion.
Kiev in the central Ukraine.
It's just in central Ukraine, yeah. but west of the disputed territory. And your sympathies are clear. You support the government in the fight against the rebels. I'm just wondering, how close to unanimous is that sentiment around Kiev? I assume that, I mean, you've already said there's a lot of Russians spoken around Kiev, but I assume there are also ethnic Russians and maybe some who have come over fairly recently. I mean, is it your sense that there is much support for the rebels at all in the Kiev area?
No. In Kiev, there is no support for separatists, and I mean, as I repeat, the many Russian speakers were on Maidan, and Kiev is mostly Russian. I would say that this is a 70% Russian speaking city, and still it had 70-75% of support for Maidan events, and many Kiev dwellers were organizing it. So as far as Russians are concerned, basically the trend that I see, that people having relatives in Russia and communicating with them are tending, you know, to split the relations or to quarrel than to stick to their point of view. Mm-hmm. Because there is an alienation of the nations of these two peoples, of Russians and Ukrainians, which is very, you know, very, very tough, because both populations are consolidating and both populations are thinking that the others are manipulated. I think that Ukrainians have more grounds to believe that Russians are manipulated and vice versa, but still. And as far as all my Russian-speaking friends are, of course, against the separatists, and even those that had some sympathies, had many sympathies to Russia, used to watch Russian television and basically were even kind of still rooted in this Soviet, post-Soviet and Russian culture, are very now very pro-Ukrainian and very hostile to all the attempts of separatism. So this is not a question for central Ukraine. Of course, it's not a question for Western Ukraine, and this is not even a question for Southern Ukraine, because Odessa, Mykolaiv, Kherson, and some part of Eastern Ukraine, Dnipropetrovsk, Kharkiv, showed that pro-Ukrainian forces are consolidating, mobilizing, and they're younger, they're more energetic, and they're more simply humane. Mm-hmm. But of course, in Donbass, the situation is different.
Okay. I said that was the final question, but I actually have one more, come to think of it. I have felt all along that Putin really did not want to invade, really didn't want to send troops into Ukraine. Do you think, and do people there generally think, there is much chance of that happening?
Yes, I think basically that he would avoid official invasion. He would do anything possible to avoid, full-scale war between Ukraine and Russia. So we are balancing on a very tiny thing. And for Ukraine, it creates much problem because, for example, Ukraine is not announcing a military emergency state in Donbass. Because to announce a military state, you have to say that you are having a war against somebody, And we all understand that we are having a war against Russians, but if we announce it publicly, Russians will say, well, Let's do the war then on a different scale. So I think that he basically tries to, as I repeat, to keep the conflicts ongoing in Ukraine for years with other hands. And this is basically the strategy of Russia since many years, since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Look at Transnistria in Moldova, look at Nagorno-Karabakh, look at Georgia. This creation of these secessionist regions, which are so-called frozen conflicts, but which are basically supported by Russians and the force of the resource for destabilizing. The problem with Ukraine is that it's much more, large scale than Transnistria, even south of Ossetia.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you,
Volodymyr. I know you've got plenty to do there, and we appreciate this. And I hope that things get better there soon.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Take care.
Take care.